Superbrain is a labour of love. Alas, no podcast can survive on love alone. We don't have a sponsor, so we need your support for Superbrain to stay alive and kicking. You can make a one-off donation by following the Support This Show link in the show or episode description.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Hello, and welcome to Superbrain, the podcast for everyone with a brain. My name is Sabina Brennan, and thank you for joining me for part two of my chat with broadcaster and lead singer with Something Happens, the one and only Tom Dunn. If you haven't listened to part one, feel free to go back. It's a lovely, fun episode. But equally, feel free to just continue listening to this episode. With me as host, no episode is ever linear. I tend to hop all over the place like I do in real life conversations. And I hope that you think that's a good thing, because I very much want all of my chats with my guests to be real conversations. A listener asked me this week how long I'd known Tom, because they thought we sounded like we'd known each other for a very long time. Actually, recording the podcast was my very first time ever speaking to Tom. I guess the fact that Tom and I were born just a year apart and both grew up in Dublin makes for easy conversation, because we have an awful lot of references from our past histories and our lives and the music we grew up with, that sort of thing. I have to say that chatting to him sparked some really old, long-forgotten memories. I don't do prep conversations with my guests before podcasts. I just like to dive right in and see where the conversation takes us. This episode takes us to the point in Tom's life 2 years ago where he literally almost died as his kidneys failed following heart surgery. Thankfully, he survived and is not only in great form and great health, he is a fantastic storyteller, even when that story involves ICU, kidney failure, heart surgery, hallucinations and post-traumatic stress.
So about 10 years or so ago, you got told you had something like a murmur or something in a bicuspid aorta.
2007.
Right.
These are dates I find you don't forget. Yeah, we were buying the house I'm sitting in now, and I lashed off to do a medical for the life insurance for the mortgage.
So it was just one of these routine medicals?
Yeah.
For Irish Life?
Irish Life, yeah.
That's where I worked for 15 years.
I applied to Irish Life and they rejected me.
Did you really? Oh my God. Well, you know what? I left school in 79.
Yeah.
So you're about a year.
I left school in 78.
Okay, so there's a year between us. I left in 79. I was the youngest of five. And my father had worked in Irish Life since he was 18. And his biggest ambition for his kids was that one of his kids would work in Irish Life. And the other four all tried and didn't get in. For people listening, you know, back in the day, you had to do aptitude tests and little exams to try and get called for interview for jobs. So, yeah, I got that. And I stayed there for bloody 15 years.
15 years.
15 years. How terrible is that?
Wow.
What a waste. That's some of the reason I can't listen to some songs, etc.
And they sponsored, Irish Life sponsored an arts award then. Nice. In 1990, and we won it.
Wow.
Newcomer. So we'd go to an awards ceremony down in Irish Life. Daniel Day-Lewis was there, while that foot was out.
Right.
So I managed to give my acceptance speech and say, you know, I was once rejected by Irish Life, but here I am now in Irish Life.
You see, though, there's that rejection.
Yeah.
You know, instead of that job in Irish Life.
Exactly.
Actually, that was something, I'm jumping around the place, but my listeners are well used to this. So just go with the flow. That reminded me that you studied engineering in UCD.
I did, yeah. I actually worked as an engineer.
Did you? I thought you told me when we were setting up here, you're not techie. Is that different to being engineer-y?
Yeah, there's a thing now. Yeah, engineering.
It's mathematical, really, is it?
Theoretically, you're going to end up in a kind of management type level in an engineering world. I did love science and I still watch science programs, I adore them. But it was the era of computers and I really wanted to be in some way involved with computers. So you go into first year and there's 200 people in the same class. And at the end of first year, depending on your results, you're split up between electronic that everybody wanted to do, electrical, mechanical. So I didn't do great at the end of first year and I ended up in mechanical, which I wasn't terribly interested in. And I tried to leave, but there was nowhere to go. So I stayed and did it. And then I worked for CIE for a year. Yeah, that was very entertaining.
CIE is Corazon per Air and it's our national bus service. We have a lot of listeners in the UK. So,
well, if anybody is on holidays in Ballina, I recommend you stop by the bus station there and admire the mechanical services, such as the bus hoist installed by me. The compressor installed by me.
So, I don't even really know what a compressor is, but yeah.
Pressurized air. So then I did a year
there. No, you don't have to answer that one.
Then I did a year in Aer Lingus.
Oh, I applied there too. I got there a ground hostess or something, but my father told me that Irish Life was a much better job.
You would have got free travel with Aer Lingus, which is serious.
I know, but I got a mortgage at 24 with Irish Life.
All right. Okay. Well, swings and roundabouts.
Yeah.
Aer Lingus wasn't great crack.
Yeah.
I didn't really like it. Even though it looks great on paper, I was a development engineer for it.
Yeah. No, they were all the same. They're just kind of corporate jobs. Yeah. I mean, for people listening, it's kind of hard to understand that back in the day when we left school, the pinnacle of success on leaving school was getting a job in the bank.
Yeah.
You know, it really was. And like, you're one of the few people who would have gone to university around that time. You know, it wasn't common for everyone to go to university.
No, it wasn't at all.
And it was very uncommon for girls to go. You know, I mean, really, there was a handful of all the girls in my year, more the boys in. I went to Holy Faith Clontarf and the boys' school was St. Paul's Raheny. So more the boys would have gone.
Yeah.
And really just the children of professionals.
Yeah, it was very, I have to say, it was very unusual for my social background.
Was it?
Yeah, I was the only person in the class, James Street, who went, and in my family.
Oh, you went to James's?
Yeah.
Oh, I went to, one of my boyfriends in Irish Life went to Jambo.
Did he really?
Yeah, Fergie Kyo. And he was a singer too, actually. He could sing. Yeah, you know, he didn't have a band, you know, but that's what we did. God, we worked in really boring job.
Well, didn't everybody?
Oh, yeah. And we worked to kind of party and go on holidays.
Yeah, I listened to the Joy Division book recently as well. And Ian Curtis was in the civil service. So no one thought music was the remotely possible thing to do. You thought, with a bit of luck, if I get a year at this and we get to make an app, I'll be proud of that for the rest of my life. You didn't think you want to make a living.
Exactly. So I always wanted to be an actor. I always wanted to act, you know, and I studied drama from the age of 8 and I did all my drama exams with the Guildhall School of Music and Drama. I just, exactly what you described that you experienced. I can still remember my very, very first time on stage at the age of 8 in a competition, a poetry competition in Father Matthew Hall, doing the Fesh, standing up there and saying the poem. And then you went backstage, they call you up in groups of 10. You went back, you came out, you did your poem and like, the audience was just full of mammies, hardly even any daddies, you know, and you'd say your poem and the adjudicator sat there and had to listen to 100 kids saying the same poem, you know, and then you'd get called back to say a second poem. So you had to have two prepared, but it had to be the same so that they would be judging, you know, on a par. And I remember then you walked down the front steps and back to where you sat after you performed. And I remember walking down, still to this day, and this raucous applause and other people's mammies stopping me and going, that was amazing.
Really?
You were brilliant. Oh, incredible. I've never experienced that again, but that was the... it was because I remember that going through my head. That's not even my mommy. And their daughter's up there and they're telling me I was brilliant. And it was an under-12s competition and I won it. But I loved the drama. You know, I remember the teacher, Miss O'Regan, God rest her soul, she died very young. I remember her coming into the classroom and saying, I'm starting these classes after school and it's called speech and drama and this is what we do. And I remember running home and saying, I want to do it. And I remember being in the class and probably being the only kid in the class who fully went with every, because it was all a bit arty at that point, you know, be a tree tree and all that sort of stuff. And I fully went with it. I just loved it. But like you just said, it never entered my head that a human being like me, a regular person, could be an actor.
No.
They were people on a screen, and somehow it just actually never entered my head that I could actually pursue it as a career.
And punk rock was very liberating for that. It made the point that it's more about you and what you have to say, and it's not about your musicianship, and those skills can follow later. That was a real, that was what really got me going. And even, it's funny, Tracy Thorn, in her book, she talks about how when they were offered this tour at U2, but that was the moment where she said, I never signed up for this. This is like me becoming Sade. I'm not Sade. I'm a girl who was doing English in college, and she and her boyfriend wanted to be in a band. And I can't believe it's gone as far as it's gone. But there's no way I'm walking on stage and thinking people should be watching me while I'm singing. Like, this has gone far enough. This is it. Yeah. And that's the way we were. We thought like we were.
I saw Sade perform in
Stadium.
The stadium.
National Stadium.
Yeah. Saw her in the National Stadium. Saw Rory Gallagher there too as
well. Oh, wow. Nice one.
Yeah, but I was stuck behind a pillar. You know, you got cheaper seats. Do you remember there was two big
pillars? Absolutely.
Anyway, the medical. Yeah. We should go back there.
And I remember I went to it from the gym. I actually was carrying a gym bag. I've been running on the treadmill and all this kind of stuff. So I was fit. And the doctor said, you know, there's a murmur there. Needs to be checked, you know?
Yeah.
And I was kind of, one or two doctors had mentioned it to me, and I thought it's nothing much, you know. And Alan had a murmur, you know, and no ill effects.
And also the name of it, murmur, it just sounds so gentle, doesn't it?
Yeah, it's kind of the sound it makes. It's kind of, you know, it's quite similar to the sound that the thing makes. The blood goes forward and back slightly. I was sent off to a cardiologist, and straight away he said, yeah, you've got a murmur. It's a serious murmur. They did more scans. They said it's a bicuspid valve. Your aorta should have three little interlocking flaps. Yours has two. So it's not sealing. So blood is leaking backwards all the time. The aorta is working harder to try and correct this. It's pumping more blood than normal. This is aging the aorta, and the aorta is calcifying.
And you know, that's not good for your brain either.
Is it not? No.
No, because your brain depends on your cardiovascular system to provide it with the nutrients and oxygen to function.
Right.
So if it's malfunctioning, it will be deprived of oxygen and the nutrients. And that's its fuel.
Yeah.
So that's why one of the animations I've made is, why is high blood pressure bad for my brain? Because it is bad. And actually, you know, and it's just to explain. And I just think it's funny. People know a lot about their heart, but they don't know a lot about their brain and how things impact.
I think the aorta was actually compensating for this. So I had normal blood pressure.
Oh, yes. So it would be over time. Do you know what I mean? So basically what was happening by the sounds of things is, yes, your heart was pumping and doing everything correctly, but it was putting itself under stress, and it wouldn't be able to continue at that pace.
Yeah,
and
exactly.
Level.
So it develops stenosis, which is the hardening of the artery of the aorta. And when it was measured the first time, it was moderate stenosis. And, you know, he was talking that, you know, the valve is down to about 3/4 of what anybody else's is. And that's fine. So he said, work away. The fitter you are, the better. So don't leave the gym. Continue to run. Stay as fit as you can. So every year I'd go and see Niall. Every year it was fine. Every year it was moderate stenosis. No change. Then he said, you come every 2 years from now on, because it's really, this isn't moving. And he did say, when it does move, we're talking surgery. And that was frightening. You know, it was scary.
Because I'm trying to figure out the math. You were in your 40s then.
Yeah. Yeah, it would have been around 45 or so.
Okay. Yeah. So that's kind of a bit shocking, hearing things about your heart at that age.
Yeah, it is. So then I don't know what happened to me, but I missed a few years. I may have missed as many as 3 years. I don't know how I did it. I felt fine. I think that might have been the thing, that I felt fine.
Do you know what? That's something I'm glad you kind of brought that up, because I did read that in some of your interviews. And I think it's kind of part of what helps us survive. You know, we're adaptable.
Yeah.
Over time, we adapt to things happening to us or to shocking information. And it sort of became your new norm, and that it was okay and it wasn't shocking anymore. And I think that happens a lot of people.
Yeah.
I think that people just become complacent, and you've dealt with it initially, the first shock, I'll have to look after this. And then it's, hey, I'm fine. So I would imagine what you did was perfectly normal.
Yeah, I would also bump into Niall, the cardiologist. He was a huge REM fan.
Right.
Yeah, so we would just compare notes with bands, and I'd meet him out, and he'd be coming over. And a little bit of me was saying, if there was the least thing wrong with me, he'd be saying, you must come in, Tom. You know,
right.
You must come in. But I wasn't getting any of that.
But it was socially. You were only chatting to him socially.
So you would expect, though, you know.
Or something, you know. I was just bouncing along. And in 2018, I did think mentally inside, on some intuitive level, I felt something had shifted. And that was, I don't know if you remember, a particularly beautiful summer. And we were swimming with the girls all the time. All the time. And I started to find, I was thinking, will I have a scar? I started thinking, will I have a scar? Now, the next time I'm on a beach, will I have a big scar? You know?
Right.
And this was starting to go into my mind. And then Fela was gone that year. And I drove down to Limerick and then I drove to Kilkenny. And in Kilkenny, I was wiped. And there was
tired.
Little bit of a scene where Audrey was saying to me, you're being so rude to my mother, you know? And I wasn't, I just wasn't responsible.
You were just irritable.
I was just dead.
All right.
And going out to dinner, I wanted to say, can we not go to dinner? Can I go to bed? This was 6:30 in the evening.
Yeah.
So I got through it and she was saying, you were fantastic crack tonight. Thank God we came down to Kenny, you know.
Does she feel suitably guilty about that now?
Yeah. The next day I said to her, I don't think that was normal. I think that was something. She said, if you don't go to the doctor, you know, there'll never be a warm meal in this house again.
Yeah.
So I went back to see him just when Fado was getting closer. And he normally was just very cheery and, you know, off the cuff with me, but he was definitely different with me and kept me waiting, which is very unlike him. And I could see people coming in after me and then going into him. And I was thinking, I was here first. What's going on here?
Yes, yes.
You know? So he said he wanted to talk to me. So we talked about Fela and he said, like, the bands are untouched by age. And he tapped his little result and said, things have shifted here, you know. The readings are gone, you know, up a lot. And he said, it might be a good idea just, you know, to see the surgeon. Now, the way he said this, it came across to me as just a kind of long-term plan. Get to know the man who at some point in the far distant future will have to do something to you, you know. And I said, yeah, sure, no problem. And his secretary kind of said, see the surgeon, have you? You know, and I was going, that's fine, just, you know, long-term, no problem, you know, don't be worrying about it. So then I went to the surgeon October the 13th. I know the date's off by heart now.
Yeah.
Did a CT scan for him. But I've been asked to be on Dances with Stars. And I know.
Yeah.
And I didn't really want to do it, but the girls wanted me to do it, right?
Yeah.
Well, that'd be
and
great
the things
crack,
we do for the kids. You know, yeah.
Great crack, da, you know.
So I was at the back of my mind thinking it'd be a great way to get fit. So I said, yeah. I'd love to get fit.
I think that's why most people do it, isn't it?
So I sat with the surgeon, you know, and all that was going through my mind was, would I be able to get fit for Dances with Stars, you know? So I said this to him, I said, you know, I've been approached, and he was looking at me like I had two heads, right? And he's tapping the results seems to be a thing, you know? And he said, these figures, with what's in front of me, you have a 70% chance of being dead within 2 years. Right? And I was going, what was that? Just say that again. And I said, so you'd need to see me, you know. And he said, yeah. And he said, within weeks. I need to see you within weeks, Tom. So I said, oh, Christ. So I kind of poo-pooed him a little bit and said, can we push this out till after Christmas? Just I want to have Whelan's. That's what I want. I wanted to play Whelan's. Didn't want
right.
to do that.
Yeah.
And he was very reluctant. He said, yeah, okay. And then I was ringing Niall, the cardiologist, and I was saying, Jesus, you know, he's a laugh a minute, isn't he? The surgeon. You know, what's the story with him? And I was saying, like, God, no, you were, you know, very relaxed. He's talking to me about valves. He's saying, what valve type do you want, mechanical or tissue, you know? And I think I was just not quite taking on board
how
serious it was. So the surgeon had said, if you get any chest pains, you must immediately go to A&E. So I had chest pains by Friday. That was a Wednesday, a chest pain. This was stress, you know, but I went to A&E and I was kept in. And they were saying, like, this is serious now. And it is stress this time, but we're putting you on beta blockers and, you know, you have a condition and you're going to have to sort this. So Jim was doing it, the surgeon was doing his rounds and he said, I'll get you in as soon as we can. So it became November the 14th. It was the next date. And that was like the phony war, you know, it was very surreal. And I was out to
what did you call it?
The phony war. You know, it's like, you know, when Germany invaded Poland and England declared war and then nothing happened.
Oh, right. Okay.
It was like I had this coming towards me, but I was still walking the dog and going for swims and
right. Okay.
And fine, basically. But this date was coming. And the thing surgeons will say to you is that it's like being hit by a car. So you're fine today. Tomorrow, you're going to wake up finding you've been knocked down and you're in great discomfort and there's a lot going on with you.
Hi, this is Craig Robinson from Ways to Win, and support for this podcast comes from Invesco QQQ. The future isn't scary, not realizing its potential, however, could be. Just like on the recruiting trail, I've seen potential come in many forms as a coach. Learn more at Invesco.com/QQQ. Let's rethink possibility. Invesco Distributors, Inc.
When you're ready to pop the question, the last thing you want to do is second-guess the ring. At BlueNile.com, you can design a one-of-a-kind ring with the ease and convenience of shopping online. Choose your diamond and setting. When you find the one, you'll get it delivered right to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off your purchase. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
So that was stressful, and loads of it is tough. You know, it was yeah, I don't own pajamas, and I had to buy something to wear in hospital, you know. Didn't want the kids to know about this, you know, I had to kind of keep that from them.
How old were your kids at that
stage? They were at that stage, what are they now? 12. They were 10 and 12.
Okay, so they're still very young. Yeah.
And then, you know, we kind of quietly, I hate it this time. I have to say, as I look back on the whole experience, that's nearly my least favorite part of it.
Okay.
You know, going off to buy an electric shaver, that you'll need an electric shaver, all this kind of stuff. Hated it. And then went for an Indian lunch, Audrey and I, and then checked into the hotel. It felt like a hotel, you know, it was over in the Beacon.
You just said checked into the hotel.
I did, yeah. That's exactly what it felt like. I arrived at the reception desk and I said, Tom Dunn. And then I have to say, there's a thing which really I'll take to the grave. You're no longer Tom Dunn, you're Thomas Dunn. And
right.
You're giving your date of birth about every 5 minutes to everyone you meet, you know, 1964, 61, just to everybody, you know. And that was very surreal as well. So the nurse then, the admissions nurse, she certainly communicates with you that you're in a serious world now. That goes across, you know.
Right.
Says things to Audrey, like, when you come and visit them, don't come alone. You know, you're going to get a shock. Yeah, exactly. Went in. Went through all the tests, or they do loads of extra scans on you and shave your chest and stuff. And then just, you had a sleeping tablet and woke up, and Audrey was there, and a man came and said, I will bring you down safely and I'll bring you back safely. And that was Thursday morning about 8:30. I went down. I vaguely remember being introduced to the anaesthetist, and the next thing I was waking up the following Wednesday.
Yeah.
So I had no idea. I had no idea how much time had passed. I'd had these dreadful nightmares. They really were, awful. And I'm reading about this guy, a friend I know, has been through COVID hell in England. And he's talking about the nightmares and feeling he was tricked, feeling these people were trying to kill him, that they were all exactly the things that were going on in my nightmares. So I woke up with somebody saying to me, would you like some ice cream? Which is a very nice way to wake up anywhere, you know. But because I've been in and out of consciousness so much, I didn't really know if this was real. That was really, you know, there was still a chance this was just another, you know, brighter moment in a nightmare. So over her shoulder, I could see a glass of water, and there was condensation on it. It looked like the nice thing in the world, because you can't actually drink when you're in ICU. They just wet your mouth with a sponge,
right,
which isn't very satisfying. So I was looking at the water, and I thought, I'll risk it, I'll ask, you know. That's asking to see if these are real people. So, could I have a glass of water, you know? Yes, it's passed over. And I thought, this is it. I'm back. I actually am back. The nicest glass of water ever tasted.
Yeah.
So then she was saying, like, we're going back on the ward today. I'm like, okay, good. Yeah. Then in a wheelchair, I'm just accepting it, you know, not even thinking about it. And then getting to just at the door of my room, I can see my room that I'm going to, which is the room I checked into on the first night in the hotel. And a nurse suddenly stops me, a young nurse. Come on, come up there now, and we'll try and see if you can walk, you know. So that bright cheeriness, you know.
I
couldn't walk 2 feet, but I gave it a go. know, and then she said, you'll be doing laps of this now in 2 or 3 days. So it's funny, but everything seemed very positive at that point. You know, I felt I will be doing laps within 2 or 3,
yeah,
you know. And I was delighted to get back into the room.
Could have been the drugs. I'm sure
you're hallucinating now. The hallucinations were spectacular.
Yeah.
There was a party going on in the next room all the time, singing and dancing. And I'd say to people, what's the story on the party? I just see these blank expressions, right?
It could be delirium with the serious infection. It could well be, you know.
I thought they were lying to me. And there is a party. So as I was able to move a little bit, I made my way out into the corridor. And I could see there was no party going on. I could see somebody would be reacting and, you know, there isn't a party. But the party was very real. And it was Audrey's dad
that
was the main culprit at the party. And there were glasses and, you know, will we have one more for the ditch and all that kind of thing. And people singing songs and Audrey there as a young Audrey with her young sister, you know. And so it was a McDonald family do that I was listening to.
Yeah.
There were real songs to the point where I Googled one of the songs and it was a World War II song.
That's mad. Do you know what you will find fascinating? It's your brain. That's why I love the brain, because it's what your brain is doing. So two things. I did an episode of this podcast with neuroscientist Adrian Owen. He's an OBE, right? And he studies consciousness. So his patients, his participants, are people who are in a vegetative state.
Yeah.
So you might find the episode interesting because I go across sort of his career, because he actually made this discovery that a lot of people who are thought to be in a vegetative state are actually conscious and aware. It's like a little history of neuroscience, because when he started over 30 years ago. So you can actually see what, as the technology grew, he was able to develop tests with MRI scanners and EEG and all that to actually tap in. So a few of the patients he studied actually came back to consciousness and could recollect some of the things and some of the issues that you're saying. Yeah. His book is called Into the Gray Zone. So I'd say you'd love his book anyway, and you might find the episode interesting, but there was one funny moment in it where a thing that people do, you know, when people are in comas and they say, what's their favorite song, you know, bring it in, and people bring it in and keep playing, you know, whatever the song is. One of the patients, it was a woman, and she was a Celine Dion fan, and apparently when she came to, the first thing she said was, if I ever hear Celine Dion again. She could hear the whole time. So it was like just this permanent torture.
I had in my dream, I had one of the nurses knew I was in music and was deliberately playing crap music to me.
No.
Yeah.
How do you know it was deliberate?
She'd say it.
No.
Yeah, it was weird. Yeah,
there's lots of
different layers in those dreams. They were dreadful. God.
I have, from my personal life, an experience when you said there about the beacon, my mum became delirious and very unmanageable, very suddenly, as a consequence of an acute kidney infection, which is quite a common trigger. You know, it's something that happens. Oh, it happens much more commonly than it should.
My kidneys failed.
Yeah, I'm not surprised. And I would say a lot of you were having a delirium, actually, you know, when you're saying hallucination. So basically what happens is if you get a severe infection and a kidney infection, the brain can dehydrate and cytokines interfere with your brain's ability to function. And so your brain just completely malfunctions. So essentially that's what happened to my mother. I mean, I had been talking to her in the car on the way to work, and she said, will you meet me for coffee today? And I said, I can't, I'm in meetings all day, mum, but tomorrow's Saturday, I'll meet you. And I was in Trinity, and when I went into Trinity, I have a brother that kind of had lived at home with my parents even into his 40s, and he rang me and he said, mom's going crazy, I need help, mom's going crazy, because he would just wouldn't have known what to do anyway. Oh, she was screaming and wanted to leave the house, but she wasn't dressed. Like, I mean, literally that kind of quick. So I was actually working with a geriatric psychiatrist. I shared an office with him at that time. And I said, I'm sorry, I'm going to have to cancel meetings and go home. And I explained literally what had happened. And he said, get her to give you a urine sample. It sounds like she's a really acute kidney infection and she'll need to go on antibiotics. And it transpired she'd been, and this is something I'm passionate about saying to older people, we often think that a signal of a serious infection is a temperature, right? A high temperature. Mm-hmm. But as we get older, we lose the ability to mount a temperature in face of some infections. So you can have a very serious kidney infection and not be aware.
Okay.
And what happens is, and what had happened with my mother was, she was getting frequency of urination. Yeah. And so she stopped drinking water because she felt she couldn't go out the house without needing to pee.
All right.
So that doubly affected it. So our brain became completely dehydrated, very serious infection, and very obstreperous. It was impossible to control her. She just developed this huge will. And the only way that I could get her to hospital was tell her that I was going to take her to a really fancy hotel for a break. And I brought her over to the Beacon and we got her in to the hotel. It was the only thing that I could do. But then she was there for about 6 weeks. She ended up being in hospital for about 6 months. You know, she had serious delirium. But a lot of the things that you're talking about in that particular hospital, music just took hold. And she would just sing nursery rhymes for hours and hours on end.
Weird, isn't it?
Hours on end. And she would be up dancing jigs. And eventually, I remember another time then when she was moved to a different hospital, she'd been made the CEO of the hospital and they were taking her in a spaceship that the hospital had just bought. And we were able to track it back to she'd been taken up for an MRI scan. But that's what her brain was trying to make sense.
Yeah.
They've taken me up to the top. So it turned around that the MRI scanner was on the top floor. And so that became being CEO of the hospital and being sent off. And, you know, it's kind of really interesting stuff. And then one other thing you said earlier when you were saying something niggled, you know, something niggled that you knew there was something amiss and you started thinking about what would I be like with the scar. I think that was your brain telling you. I think that was your brain, that what I'm talking about, that brain gathering all the pieces of information that you didn't particularly notice, but it was noticing and going, something here, something here, something here. And the scar, we need to think about this surgery thing, because it's literally just taking the information and making a decision or trying to force a decision for you. I suspect that's what was happening.
What's the thinking then? Because when I came back after it, it was very emotional after it. And I only needed to think about it and it had become very emotional. And I remember I did the late show. I was very emotional just before going out. I didn't want to go out, but then I managed to get a handle on it and go through and not be emotional. I didn't want to be emotional on camera. But the idea that I've been thinking about this a lot since.
Yeah.
I kind of feel like my body had an incredible trauma. And if you think about it, you know, they opened my chest. Imagine open that out. They stopped my heart and operated on it, replaced a piece in it, replaced three pieces in it while he was in there. And then put everything. My brain must be going, what on God's earth is happening to me here? And must have some way to try and process that afterwards. I mean, there must be a level of post-traumatic shock that goes with that.
Oh, absolutely. So stress was first studied in the context of illness.
Yeah.
So we think about stress as more a psychological thing. It's physiological, but it's also psychological. I mean, it really doesn't matter whether a threat or a stressor is real or imagined. The stress response will kick off. But it was initially studied in the context of illness, because seriously ill people, your body is put under stress and your brain is put under stress. So your brain, essentially, it's really rather interesting. I find it fascinating anyway, but we can talk about our brain, us as having three brains. Okay, we don't, they're integrated. But from an evolutionary perspective, we have three brains. So the first part is your brain stem, which you'll have heard about from watching, and it's called the reptilian brain. It's the oldest part of the brain, okay? It is completely unconscious, and it is responsible for keeping you alive. It is responsible for your breathing, your heart rate, your digestion, things you don't actually have to think about, okay? If that's damaged, you're screwed, basically, unless you have access to a life support machine to do those things for you, okay? You don't have to think about those things. The next part of the brain to evolve was the emotional brain. We call it, it's the limbic system. Really, to see it, you'd have to turn the brain upside down. It's in there, you know, under the crinkly stuff. And that's often referred to as the emotional brain. It houses your amygdala, which processes the stress response and the fear response, the hippocampus, which actually is involved in learning and memory and really responsible for your emotions. And again, it is unconscious and unthinking. Then the last part to evolve is the crinkly bit that you tend to think of in your brain. And that's really the part that's the thinking brain. It's the neocortex, neo meaning new. And it's where all our complex conscious thinking activities occur. So your brain is responsible for maintaining homeostasis. It's responsible for every single system in your body. And it is responsible for keeping you alive and ensuring that whatever resources it has available to it do that, and then allow you to do all those other thinking things on top of it. But if you're going to be under stress, like, you know, pulled open and your heart being bypassed literally and whatever, the primary thing is going to be using this brainstem. It's going to be about keeping you alive, and all resources have to go into keeping you alive. And that's going to be a huge stress. And I think that then can ultimately place a strain on the other parts of your brain. So you're not going to think clearly. I think that's what's happening really in a way with COVID, with people with long COVID. A lot of them are experiencing brain fog. And really, that's not unusual after any sort of serious illness like sepsis. People will have brain fog for maybe up to a year afterwards, for lots of reasons. There'll have been inflammation, immune response, etc. But also, if you think about it, the body has been put under huge stress. Your brain has to focus on keeping you alive, and really remembering where you had your keys or being able to think straight are not important in that context. And so on top of the inflammation and those kind of issues, there will be a resource issue at play, the focus. You saying that you're emotional, I mean, it seems perfectly understandable to me that you would be emotional after something like that. In that emotional part of the brain, the really interesting thing that happens when the acute stress response kicks off, right? So the acute stress response is designed to save our life, you know, fight or flee. And in your context, the stress in this was a serious surgery, you know, and it does that. But in an acute situation, and it's easier for me to explain if I do something like the standard, you know, being mugged on a dark alleyway or whatever. In an acute situation, memory is enhanced, okay? So that you remember not to go down that alleyway again or not to do that thing again. So there has to be some of that happening in your situation, you know, that some sort of issue is happening to saying, no, that was really bad. That was really serious. I can't ever go down that way again. So that has to be happening at some level in what you're doing. But then when stress becomes chronic, so usually when an acute situation passes, your thinking brain, so the information about a stressor comes into your amygdala, the part of the brain that handles the stress response, through two routes. A fast route, it goes straight to the amygdala so you can respond. Unthinking, save your life, jump out of your way of the car or get down if there's a gunshot or whatever. And then there's a slower route where it goes to the amygdala, but first it goes to your thinking brain, to your frontal cortex, which has bidirectional connections with every other part of your brain. So we can see the full context of what is going on. Okay. And makes a decision. Yes, there is a gunman over there. Stay down, keep the stress response going because we're going to maybe have to fight or run away here. Or that was a car backfiring, false alarm, let's calm down that stress response. So what happens if stress becomes chronic is essentially neuroplasticity becomes enhanced in your fear center. So your fear center starts to grow and starts to dominate, actually. So what then happens also is your hippocampus, the memory part, neuroplasticity is suppressed. So that starts to shrink. It's also suppressed in your frontal lobes, and that starts to shrink. So then what happens is, instead of your rational brain overriding your reflexive brain, your emotional brain, the reverse starts to happen. And your emotional brain starts to override your rational brain. And I suspect that maybe what you were experiencing was just this fear, this fear. Oh, my God. And the thing is, it does not matter whether there's any real stressor there or not. Yeah. So really, experience in any form of trauma. That's why if kids experience trauma in early childhood, they can have a really maladaptive stress response.
Yeah,
they can respond too quick or too big or whatever. Does that make sense to you as to what may have happened? Yeah. And I think in understanding that, that's why I'm passionate about what I do. And actually, that's what this podcast is about. It's talking about real life stuff, but trying to get a handle on it from a way that actually can help people cope. So you're kind of going, why was I feeling so emotional? Well, that's it. Mm. That was put under stress. So actually, really what you need to do is really get those back in line again. Mm. And that may mean you have to work with somebody else, because yeah. at that point, your emotional brain is ruling the roost.
Yeah, I think that was part of the plan. And I signed up for cardiovascular physio, which is brilliant in UCD every Tuesday. And that was going great on a treadmill and all that kind of stuff. But at some point, Karen was saying to me, now, you probably will need to talk to, you know, a psychologist, because, you know, you will have elements of post-traumatic stress from this. And then COVID arrived, I'm afraid.
Oh.
And that is where that stays. You know, that was literally last year.
So that's tough. Yeah. Yes. No, it would make perfect sense to me. I read in one of your articles where you said, do you think you had a little bit of post-traumatic stress?
Yeah.
But, you know, I don't think there's such a thing as a little bit. You have some sort of level of post-traumatic stress.
I can tell you what that is. It comes when things are particularly good, and things are never better than when Skye, who's 12, reaches up to hold your hand. That is the most beautiful thing in the world. And you just get this little, this will end. This will be over. This will be gone.
Right.
You know, it just goes through your mind, you know, and it's powerful. And it, you know, it's,
oh, that's terrifying.
Stops you enjoying something. I remember this before I die. It will come, you know.
And it will come to all of us.
Yeah, it will. It will.
And I should say to the listeners that you've been given an all clear now. Your heart is fixed.
This was the most incredible. When I went to him a year later, you'd go for a year follow-up, they found a tiny little lump on one lung. I know that sounds dreadful.
Oh, no.
I know. They'll find a lump in 50% of CT scans. Okay. So you get little lumps. And I think 97% of them are benign. So the statistics are all in your favor.
In your favor.
But they have to check it in a year's time. So when I never told Audrey that. So when I was going back, I was thinking the lump as well. So he said, the lump hasn't changed.
Okay.
So he said, I need to have one more scan of the lump and then we can write that off. That is no longer. But he said, on top of that, the valve is perfect.
Brilliant.
And I said, what about the 12-year thing? Because you kind of said there might be a 12-year life scan. And he said, I'm not in this case. He says, I won't be seeing you again.
Oh, fantastic.
Yeah, I know. Sensational. So
yeah,
I danced into the room after that.
Oh, you know, do you know what? My mother-in-law had a triple bypass when my eldest was about 2 or 3. And it was only in hindsight, we looked back at some videos that Christmas before she went into hospital suddenly, like, you know, it was really one of those. And I think they were going in to do a double and ended up doing a triple or whatever. And she was a smoker. She looked really ill. At that time, my parents and Dave's father were all alive and really, really healthy. And she was close to death, you know. And I, if I think back at it, it's about 28 years ago. My parents are both dead. Dave's father is dead. She turns 90 this year. You know?
Yeah.
I mean, it literally just, she never looked back from a heart perspective. She's been in and out of hospital for a little thing, you know, osteoarthritis, breaking things. This last year during COVID, and she hasn't even caught COVID.
Fantastic.
I mean, it is amazing. I think you can be very lucky when these things are found.
Yeah.
But just going back to that thing, because that's tough. I'm a health psychologist. I'm not a one-to-one, you know, I'm not a counseling psychologist, but I think it helps to just understand, because that's what I want to do, is if you understand what's actually going on in your brain, it's far easier to then switch it up to get back to where you want to be. So I really do just think it is that emotional, that fear center in your brain, just over responding.
Yeah.
And really, you know, you're in control of your thinking. So when that happens, you can, you know, if you just even switch it up and say, gosh, there's that thought again that I'm having.
Absolutely.
That's related to that. I need to start switching into that. Mm. Isn't this fab that my daughter is holding my hand? Mm. That's just cool.
Yeah, totally.
Do you know? And it really is just about retraining your brain. And it will take a while. But I still would say, if you get the opportunity to do proper therapy with someone, take it, because you need to have those tools, because you don't want to stress. There's nothing wrong with stress when it's an appropriate response. You need stress in your life to rise to challenge. You need stress, that stress response, to go on stage, you know, to be excited about stuff, to get you out of bed in the morning. That's why it evolved.
Yeah,
it's brilliant. And you need that. But when it becomes poorly managed and chronic, and if you're kind of constantly feeling, you know, if it's popping up at good moments, which is really rather interesting.
Yeah.
Like, I tend to be someone who cries when good things happen. Do you know, it's kind of funny, you know, if someone wins a competition and you see them, their dreams going, oh, that's brilliant. You know? And that seems to be something that's happening for you. And I suppose it's a relief. There's probably two things.
It'd be
hard for it to be that it's a relief. I'm still here. But also then the negative bit.
I think also the fragility of it goes through my mind, you know, and the fleetingness of it as well.
Life.
Yeah. I think that did come home to me. I think it's just ingrained in you, instilled in you that, you know, if somebody gets shot, it'll be the guy beside you, you know, it won't be you.
Oh, yeah, yeah. We all feel immortal. Yeah,
we'll be grand.
It will never be us. And that's why we tell stories. You know, our whole lives, that's how we make sense of the world. We tell stories about what's happening. And we frequently, when something bad happens to somebody else, we make up a story so that it couldn't possibly have happened to us.
Yeah, they weren't careful. They smoked.
They weren't careful. Yeah. No. Sure. What were they doing walking down that road? I'd never do that. It's just sort of part of who we are. But we are in control of that narrative. Yeah. So we can kind of change those things up a bit. And I think it's a rare occasion when, and that's why I was interested really in talking to you. It is a rare occasion to be faced directly with your own mortality.
Certainly is.
Yeah. To come out the other side and be able to judge. Like one of the things in therapy, and maybe this is another thing, I kind of feel it's my mission to get you writing again, but actually that is sometimes a way to really explore those, you know, to kind of get them out of your head.
Yeah.
I know it doesn't sound like a brilliant topic for something, but I actually think it could be a really brilliant topic for a song, you know, exploring all that through writing. I think that could be a really, really, you know, and I mean, it is, you may find you go to therapy and that's actually what they suggest. So it's something you can kind of get ahead on the game. No, seriously, that is a way is to kind of work through things.
Yeah. There's another moment too. We swim in Sandy Cove quite a bit, you know, in the freezing cold. We've done it throughout winter.
I live in Clontarf and I see people swimming in the cold all the time. Yeah.
Great thing to do. But it's just stopped now, but up to about 4 months ago, they were still at that age where they get afraid in the water. So they come right in beside me, two of them, you know. And every time they do it, I just go, this is as good as life gets.
As it
you
gets.
Know, and the sun is on the water. The water may be freezing, but the sun is on the water. These two are just so small and so dependent on me. And so I just go, oh. I'm determined to get a song out of that. Determined to capture that moment. That is just this.
Yeah, as good as it. Yeah. Because the thing is, you know, I hate to tell you this, but the teen years are coming and the teenage.
No, as I say, it doesn't happen anymore. Like that she, he was 14. She won't go with me now. She goes.
Yeah. Friend. Oh, stop. Mine used to walk, you know, it's like you were the queen because they walked a few steps.
If I walk near her, if I go for a swim myself, she goes,
Dad, go away. Yeah.
Don't come near me.
But actually might help you through. I do have another episode of the podcast on the teenage brain, because the teenage brain is phenomenal.
Fascinating.
It goes through a whole period of trans. It actually remodels itself from back to front. And when you understand that, you understand why they are so irrational, why they can't assess risk, why they keep making the same mistakes. It really, I wish I'd known it when I was kind of raising my teens, although mine weren't too bad, actually. They were pretty cool kids. But I think, I really do look forward to reading your book. I really look forward to new songs. I honestly think that it really could help you through that. And like, really, if you think about it, and maybe it'd be a nice way to roundly end this, is to come back to Parachute, that the lyrics of that song, right? That song is the most joyous song. Yeah. You just want to get up and dance. But I'll let you explain it, but it really is about breaking up.
Absolutely. Yeah, it is. As was so much of that album. Yeah, I was breaking up with somebody and they didn't really want to break up with me. And I was just trying to tell them, you'll be fine out there. You'll be fine on your own. You know, you're a beautiful young woman, you know. Head out there now and have the crack, you know, and we'll always be friends. Don't be worried.
Yeah, but it's so much nicer than it's not you, it's me. You know, that breakup line.
It was a bit of...
Or not being told. Yeah, it was a bit of that, was it?
You know, I think both of us being at a point where you needed to jump out of the airplane, you know, and you needed to see what was out there, and you weren't going to experience life until you did. And, you know, you were going to have to take flight. That was just, you're at that point in your life where you had to take flight. So that was the message.
And here you are again at that point in your life where you have to take flight. You have to jump in and write those songs.
Yeah, you seem to be at that point in your life all the time, in fairness.
Yeah.
It's not a one-off moment. It's a recurring theme.
You know, Tom is so right. It's not a one-off thing. We have the opportunity to go out there and experience life, to live life to the full every day. I really do hope that Tom writes that song about his daughters and all those other songs I suspect his brain is bursting with. Is there something you really want to do but are afraid to? What's stopping you? If it's fear of failure, well, then just go for it. You know, failure is just a part of learning. Failure is only a bad thing if you see it as the end result rather than part of the learning that life is. If it's fear of what others might say or think, well, you know what? Affect them. It's your life. We all only get one life, so just go for it. If it's something else that's stopping you, maybe something physical or financial barrier, for example, then spend some time looking at those barriers and see if you can make a plan to remove those barriers or move them a little bit or modify what you want to do in some way. You know, maybe it just means that those barriers are temporary and that you can set a plan in motion to still work towards what it is you want to do, but that it may take a little bit longer. Is there a single step that you could take today that will take you one step closer to whatever it is you want to do? Even the longest journeys happen one step at a time. My name is Sabina Brennan, and you have been listening to Superbrain, the podcast for everyone with a brain. I will include a link to the animation that explains why high blood pressure is bad for your brain that I mentioned in my conversation with Tom. Everyone should get their blood pressure tested regularly. Please do share the video with anyone that you know who needs to hear that message. And go get your own blood pressure tested. It really doesn't matter what age you are. Most pharmacies and chemists offer a free service now. Please do follow me on Instagram at Sabina Brennan. I'm new over there and trying to build up some followers. You'll be rewarded with pictures of my cute dogs as well as more brain stuff and bits and pieces from my life. Thank you so much for listening.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.